I am a crisis line worker, but that's not the job I'm going to tell you about today. I'm going to get back to the crisis line. But the job I want to tell you about is not about people. It's about animals. It's actually about the lack of animals and then too many animals all at once. I grew up not quite on a ranch, but near ranches. And I grew up so deep in the southern Washington country that I learned things like how to help deliver lambs, how to bottle feed calves in people's bathtubs, how to hairspray hairs on cows' tails. They said straight up. That's how you show them at the fair. These are all things I learned, but I was really jealous when I was learning them because all these animals, the horses, the cows, the goats, the sheep, none of them were mine. I desperately wanted more animals. I was an animal-sick kid. I had horses especially bad on the mind. I was one of those girls, little toy horses, always asking for horses. I would be anyone's friend as long as they had a horse. And the coolest horses were my best friends, the people with the coolest horses. So I would do anything I could to figure out how to get closer to animals. And the three dogs we had, the gerbils I sold cookies door to door to afford, the fish that died all the time, none of these animals were quite good enough. I needed to have more. So this was my first problem. I had a second problem, and that is that some of the animals I could get close to kept dying, and this really upset me. And we lived in a huge house with really big A-frame windows, and from anywhere in the house at any time, one could hear this big thunk of a bird hitting one of those windows. Despite trying to guard against that and prevent it, it just did not work. There were too many windows, and the birds who did it the most often were hummingbirds, the little fragile hummingbirds. And they did it so much, I had a shoebox kit prepared for them. Washcloths, little sugar feeder dropper, anything I could do to make them feel better. And I was the hummingbird rescuer. So when I heard that horrible thump noise, I'd race out onto the deck to grab a hummingbird before the dog could, because you can see where this would go. And I'd grab it with a washcloth and hold it. And a hummingbird is only the weight of a couple dimes, so you can barely feel it at all, and you can't tell whether it's okay or not. And you have to sit there and just breathe and just hold and wait. And it usually takes a stunned hummingbird maybe about 5 minutes to start whirring back to life in your hands. And it's a really cool feeling to hear this, feel and hear this bird coming back to life. And he blinks at you, and then all of a sudden he's fine, and he flies to the nearest post or tree and stares, and then he flies off. Or he doesn't, and you see the little drop of blood, and you see his neck, and you realize, back to the pet cemetery for this one. So my two problems were, okay, I can get close to some animals, and they die, and I can't have the animals I want. So I think about it, and I think a little more, and the answer is pretty obvious. Become a veterinarian, right? All the animals you want, and you make them better. So I decided to do this and successfully applied. I was accepted on scholarship to a pre-veterinary program in the Midwest. I was really excited about that. Went off to college. First year went great. I'm waking up at 8 a.m. to judge sheep sometimes, to sit in animal feed classes. These were the not-so-fun things. But I did it for the love of the animals, and it was going places, and I was excited. I'd been job shadowing at a local veterinary clinic back here in Washington. And that was where I had my job waiting for me, my summer job. Everything was on plan. So I came back. Here goes my summer job. I was really happy because I could finally be useful. Before, when I was job shadowing, I wasn't the kid who would, you know, they had big football players job shadow, and they'd have them fall over in the middle of an operation because too much blood and guts. And I was the kid who was leaning into the operation site trying to figure out everything inside that animal. So I was so glad that I could finally be useful, hand out utensils, help with anesthesia. Until the day I walked in, and one of my supervisors was crying. And I said, "Kathy, what's wrong?" And she said, "Well, you know how the economy is. Again, this is a really tiny town surrounded by country farms." And she said, "The owner had to hire her son and daughter, and we have to let you go." I was pretty resilient. I said, "That's okay, Kathy. Don't cry. I'll be fine." And I thought I would be fine. And I looked through all the ads and the classified, and there was just nothing. So after a couple weeks of really looking hard and applying hard, I realized I was going to have to do the one thing that nobody in this town ever wants to do. It's the one place that's always hiring and the place everyone is joking about. And you're like shadow pushed off to the side of the town that we make fun of. We'd see big trucks pulling up to it, feathers coming out of the trucks. It was a chicken processing plant. And I tried to make light of it. I was like, okay, so guys, I've got this funny thing, right? I spent the first half of summer making animals better, and now I'm going to spend the second half killing them. Funny, right? Oh, no, not funny. Not funny. I was pretty sad about it, actually. And I was kind of hoping they wouldn't be hiring. But I went down. Before I knew it, I had my fat binder of instructions on how to work at a chicken processing plant. I had my name and photo on a badge and handed a stack of protective gear. And I had to show up. Monday, 7:30 in the morning, I'm there. And I start the life of a chicken factory worker. And some things are immediately apparent as a chicken factory worker. You won't be surprised to know that it is incredibly, epically, filthily, disgusting, horribly disgusting. You walk in, and this is how it goes. You have a thick, like, paper, clothy kind of apron thing on, and you've got plastic protectors on your legs and your arms and a hairnet and earplugs you can't hear anything and little booties. And most of this is this bluish plastic that just gets chicken grease coated on it. And despite bleaching your chickenware every night, that smell does not come out. That smell stays. You have like a chicken fat lotion on your skin at all times. You get up and walk into a mist of chicken in the morning, and you work with it, and you work with it, and you stay in it for about 11 hours, 6 days a week. And I wasn't at the front. I wasn't actually killing, but I could have any one of four jobs, and those might be putting the stickers on the chicken packets. I thought a machine did it. Machines don't do it, at least when I was doing it. That's the person putting every little stinking sticker on. Or I could just work the line and keep putting chicken breasts and thighs and drumsticks into big bulk bags. And once in a while, I'd get the cool job with the chain mail and the big knife, and I'd get to cut chicken pieces up. But there's only so much you can entertain yourself with on a chicken line. It gets pretty old avoiding, like, the guy who comes around and tries to give you a big hug and tries to pinch your butt while he's doing it. Yay, that was happening too. So all this got really old. And out of boredom, I start to look at the people around me. We can't talk to each other because of the earplugs and the heavy clanking machinery. But I start watching them, trying to avoid things like the big tub of pink chicken goo going by. That's a real thing. Tub like a washing machine going by, shaking with chicken goo. And yeah, there are a lot of things to avoid in this place. So I start looking for things to appreciate. And I noticed some things, actually. One of the things was a little funny. I was working next to this Mexican guy who loved to make soup. And the best thing he liked to put in his soup was a chicken head if he could get it. And these would sometimes come down the line, the conveyor belt line. They weren't supposed to, but they'd make it in once in a while. And he would look around, and he'd steal it and stuff it in his apron. And he got us all in on this game. So if we saw it, it was a big competition to see who could grab the smashed chicken head and also hide it, give it to him. I noticed the Kenyan guy who would work night school after being at the chicken factory for his 11 hours, and he would still go to night school, wanted to be an electrician, just willing to work really hard. And I noticed the Vietnamese guy who had kind of given up on his own life and was totally willing to give the rest of his life. He'd already been there for 10 years, and he was probably going to go another 10 to make sure his son could go to med school. And I talked to him about it, like, how do you do this? This is so incredibly boring and mundane and tedious. And he said, it just doesn't matter. I'm here for my son. I'm going to do it for him. That's what matters. Everything for him. And I was really touched by that. And I was touched by the little things, too. Like, there was another guy who was also older, and he would get behind, and everyone would speed up on their own tasks so we could help him catch up so nobody had to get in trouble. Because the number one rule here was the conveyor belt doesn't stop. Chicken pieces don't stop. Nothing ever stops. You are a machine. So you keep going. You keep going. You help. You do what you can. You notice the humanity. And then there was the day when I noticed that some line had stopped. And there was a bunch of people gathered around it. And I was wondering, what's that? And they lifted someone up and carried her out. And it wasn't someone I knew. But I realized later, through people telling me, that this was a woman who'd been there for a while. She'd had a heart attack. And I don't think she made it that day and had to be carried out. I didn't know her, but it was still pretty sobering. And no more than 10 minutes later, that line is back up and going again. Line does not stop. I know it's not really profound, but I really started thinking about it and thinking, you know, we're all pieces in this big factory. Chicken pieces, human pieces, machine pieces, all going. And I wouldn't say this actually directly changed my life, but I went back to college at the end of summer. I could shove that chicken job, I'm done with it. Back into vet school, but I didn't stay in pre-vet school. I eventually made it over through a long path. I did photography as well. And then decided public health really mattered to me. And looking at systems we set up for people and for each other. Like, what systems do we set up for animals? What systems do we set up for ourselves? Why, if you go back to that chicken factory page, did they not even mention the hundreds of workers who work in the factory? It's all about the happy marketing people and the people running the live operations. You know, why are we paying attention to some of the things that we are and ignoring other things? And that really stuck with me, those hidden people working in the factories and those hidden chickens. And so I'm really grateful to be in public health now. I'm graduating very soon in a couple months with a PhD in it. I'm pretty excited and feel really privileged to be able to look at these kinds of patterns. And when I tell people about this job, they're always like, ew, gross. And then they have the one burning question they have to ask, and I have to answer, like, yeah, I wish I didn't as much as I still do, but yeah, I still eat chicken. So...